Welcome to today's program titled Protecting Confidential Information and Client Relationships in the Financial Services Industry. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, then type and send your question that way. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on the CLE attendance affirmation form. Please write this code down as it is required for CLE credit. Copies of the webinar recording and PowerPoint presentation will be distributed to attendees in the days following the webinar. At this time, I'd like to turn it over to Scott Humphrey. You may begin.
Thank you, and good afternoon or good morning, depending on where you are in the country on this fine Wednesday. And thank you for joining Marcus Mintz and myself on our sixth annual Protecting Confidential Information and Client Relationships in the Financial Services Industry. Marcus and I have been doing this for quite some time, and we are based here in Chicago with the law firm of Safar Shaw and are well-versed in trade secret and non-compete law, specifically with not only enforcing those agreements when you need to go to litigation, either through the courts or FINRA, but also in drafting the agreements, doing trade secrets audits, stress tests, things like that, in order to make sure the companies are keeping their confidential trade secret information safe. And as such, you know, what we're going to talk about today are really four things. One, what is a trade secret? Two, what are the steps that you and your company can do to make sure that those trade secrets and the client relationships that are generated from those trade secrets are protected? And lastly, what can you do with respect to FINRA when somebody steals your confidential information or violates your confidentiality agreements? And within that topic, one of the things that we always get asked about is how does the protocol for broker recruiting impact your ability to protect your trade secrets and to enforce those agreements as well as your restrictive covenant agreements when the time comes? And so with that, there's a nice picture of Marcus and me. And the one other thing I should add is we will field all of your questions at the end of the presentation. So please, if you have any questions that come into your mind while we're going on, by all means, please type in under the Q&A, which I believe is on the left-hand side of your screen. And when you do, we will read them and then address them all at the end of the conference. And so with that, I will turn it over to Marcus Mintz.
Hey, thanks, Scott. So as Scott mentioned, when he went through the agenda, the first thing that we'll start with today is what is a trade secret? And as at least one court has noted, it is one of the most elusive and difficult concepts in the law to define. One of the first places that we go in terms of trying to figure out what is a trade secret is the Uniform Trade Secret Act. And this is a statute that has been adopted in all the states except for New York. And even in New York, the common law is very similar to the Uniform Trade Secret Act, so that the analysis is substantially the same throughout the country. And what the UTSA does, the Uniform Trade Secret Act does, it provides a uniform definition of a trade secret. It provides explicit criteria for achieving trade secret status, as well as defining misappropriation of trade secrets and the persons and entities who can be liable for misappropriating trade secrets. And here we have the definition under the Uniform Trade Secret Act. And I'm not going to read this to you, but the essential gist of the definition is that it's got to be information that derives economic value from being secret and is the subject of reasonable efforts to keep the information secret. So in simpler terms, it's a secret and it's kept secret. And what's particularly important here is that the information it provides a competitive edge to the company. It's something that, because it's secret, it provides the company with specific monetary economic value over its competitors, whereas if its competitors have that same information, they would gain on the trade secret holder status. As well, the information cannot be reverse engineered. You know, and this isn't just a software program or a tangible device. Where we often see reverse engineering come into play is for something like a customer list. And customer lists, if they're easily duplicated, for example, by going through a trade show and collecting a bunch of business cards and putting them into a spreadsheet and calling that a trade secret, well, that might not get trade secret status if you have a bunch of other attendees that are doing the same thing or could easily do the same thing. You know, on the other hand, if you have a customer list and that list has the not just the identities of customers, but specific decision makers, their job titles and contact information there, and those individuals would not be known to competitors, then it's a completely different circumstance, and that information can be recognized as a trade secret. The second element of getting to trade secret status is that the information is kept secret. And Scott will get into this in a little bit more detail later, but what this means is that the trade secret holder must take affirmative steps to keep the information secret. And the important part here is that they must be reasonable under the circumstances. So courts are going to require something different from a multi-billion dollar company that has, you know, think of Coke and the formula for Coke. Courts are going to expect greater efforts to keep that formula secret than, say, a smaller company that doesn't have quite the same resources or economic value. So in addition to the Uniform Trade Secret Act, as of 2016, there's a federal statute that is called the Defend Trade Secret Act. And what's important about the Defend Trade Secret Act is it creates a private right of action for the misappropriation of trade secrets. It largely mirrors the Uniform Trade Secret Act. So the analysis in terms of what is a trade secret and misappropriation under the statutes is roughly the same. But importantly, it provides for federal jurisdiction for claims of misappropriation. The important caveat here is that the trade secret information itself must be used in interstate commerce. And what we've seen very recently is that some district courts have found that where pleadings do not detail how the information is used in interstate commerce have dismissed the actions for lack of jurisdiction. We've discussed what is a trade secret. The next prong of what we want to talk about is what is misappropriation under both the Uniform Trade Secret Act and the Defend Trade Secret Act. And to prove misappropriation requires the existence of a trade secret and the unconsented disclosure or use of a trade secret. And that's by one who either used improper means to acquire the secret. You know, think, for example, an outsider hacking in to someone else's computer systems and stealing their information, or someone who at the time of disclosure knew or had reason to know that the trade secret was acquired through improper means under circumstances giving rise to a duty to maintain the secrecy of the trade secret, or derived from or through a person who owed such a duty. So some examples to think about are a third party bribing someone within a company to provide access to that company's trade secrets, or someone within a company itself who lawfully has access to the information, is under a duty to keep that information secret, but nonetheless takes that information or discloses it to outsiders. Those things would all be considered misappropriation under either statute. So potential remedies for misappropriation. There's injunctive relief, for example, asking a court to require the misappropriating party to stop using the information, stop disclosing the information, to return the information to the trade secret holder. There's monetary relief available, and these would be actual, you know, consequential damages, unjust enrichment, or reasonable royalty paid over to the trade secret holder. In the case of willful and malicious misappropriation, there's punitive damages available, and as well as attorney's fees. If cases are brought in, you know, what's called bad faith, there is a fee-shifting provision where the court can award attorney's fees to the defendant in a trade secret action. So what is a little bit different about the Defend Trade Secret Act that is from the Uniform Trade Secret Act is immunity and anti-retaliation provisions. And we think about these as whistleblower protections, essentially. And the Defend Trade Secret Act explicitly provides immunity to individuals under any federal or state trade secret law who discloses a trade secret made to a federal, state, local government official, to an attorney to get advice or report or investigate a violation, and even in a complaint or other document, provided that the trade secret information is made under seal. And what's important for you all here is that under the DTSA, a notice is required to be included in any employment or other agreement with employees providing for the immunity under the Defend Trade Secret Act. And the consequence of not including this information is that in the event of misappropriation and proving that such misappropriation was willful and malicious without providing for immunity language in the agreement, there's no recovery of punitive damages or attorney's fees. So to the extent that agreements have not been updated since 2016, we recommend that they should be updated to include the DTSA immunity language. Just by way of example of, you know, specific to the financial services industry, information that may be considered trade secrets. You know, the first bucket there, you know, think these are customer client related information, detailing the identities of clients, their practices and preferences, how their financial assets are allocated, the internal modeling documents. This is internal proprietary data. It could be software programs, algorithms, things within the company itself that they use to carry out their specific services that are proprietary, give an edge, something different than the competitors. And finally, you know, internal opportunities and trends, forward-thinking documents, things that companies plan to do, targets that have been identified, strategies for going after new business, potential new markets, and opportunities. But at the end of the day, any information that meets the definition of a trade secret, that is, provides economic value to the trade secret holder and is under reasonable efforts to keep that information secret, can be considered a trade secret. So we've talked about what information can be a trade secret, and here we've listed some information that may not be a trade secret. And obviously, anything that's public or can easily be obtained from publicly available information, think social media posts, blogs, certainly if it's in the Wall Street Journal, all those categories of information are obviously not trade secrets. So if you see it on Facebook, probably not a trade secret. So just to go through some recent case decisions just over the past few months, the first one is Frankie Smith and Mark Kielbasa, and these were two individuals who were high-ranking employees at a Wyoming-based bank. And right now, there's the Federal Board of Governors is taking disciplinary action against these two individuals, all arising from their misappropriation of trade secrets from their former employer. These two individuals had access to a wide variety of information at the bank, and what they did was hatch a scheme to move to a competitor, and they began accessing information which they legally had access to, and then uploading that information to Dropbox, which for those of you who may not be familiar, is a cloud-based electronic storage repository. So think, you know, Google Drive is another example. So this wasn't discovered yet. They moved this information to a competitor and misappropriated the trade secrets. And there was a underlying civil trial, which resulted in a multi-million dollar verdict against these individuals. And, you know, what's important or notable about this case is that the fact pattern is not unusual. We often see in the types of litigation matters we get involved in the use of software like Dropbox and other cloud-based storage accounts. We see the use of personal email, as well as USB drives and other electronic things. So this just underscores the need for trade secret holders to be on the lookout for not just printing off documents and walking out with them, not just electronic devices, but unusual data transfers, and to employ safeguards that protect against that type of data theft. Another recent case just last year, FinTech Fund, VHorn. This case involved a financial technology company that used blockchain technology in biometric authentication services. And the defendant was a CEO of the company's UK affiliate. And the CEO was alleged to have induced the US affiliate to provide him with access to the U.S. company's servers under some pretext, and then once the individual had access, he misappropriated trade secrets and he sabotaged the company's ability to access that information. And what's notable about this case is, though, even though the individual was based in the U.K., because he reached out to Texas and duped a Texas-based individual to giving access to the servers. And because the servers were located in the U.S., the court found that the individual could be sued in the Southern District of Texas. So these are just some recent illustrative cases providing what types of information in the financial services industry have been afforded trade secret protection, and other sort of examples of instances where information has been misappropriated in the financial services industry. So with that, now that we're about 20 minutes in, we'd like to give you the CLE code, which is S as in Seifarth, S4672. So again, that's SS4672. And then with that, I'm going to turn it over to Scott Humphrey.
Thanks, Marcus. And so the next natural lead-in after Marcus has given you the backgrounds as to what is and is not trade secrets is how do you protect them? Because obviously the one thing you don't want, as we show here, is somebody who doesn't have and shouldn't have access to your confidential information actually getting a hold of it, and then even worse, using it against you and taking your competitive advantage away from it being confidential and using it to their own competitive advantage. And so one of the first questions that Marcus and I get a lot is, well, you know, why does it need to be kept secret? What do we need to do? Things like that. And the two obvious statements are right here is that, you know, public disclosure of a trade secret destroys its status as a trade secret. It means that you can no longer seek damages for it. You can no longer claim that you get a competitive advantage of it because it's now out in the open. The more interesting thing that I would note is something that Lex Matcha just recently came out with about 3 or 4 weeks ago. And they did a study of all the trade secret cases that have been filed across the country in the last 9-10 years. And what they found was that 15% of the trade secret cases were dismissed at the very beginning. And it wasn't just because, as Marcus pointed out earlier, that people failed to allege, say, in the last couple of years under the Defend Trade Secrets Act federal court jurisdiction, but that these courts were actually knocking these cases out at the very beginning, 15% of them, which is not a small amount, because it wasn't pled in the complaint that the company had taken the proper reasonable measures to protect its trade secrets. And that's even more interesting when you consider that in the last 3 years since the Defend Trade Secrets Act has come out, there's been a significant rise. I believe the number is around almost like 1,000% in trade secret cases because you now have automatic federal court jurisdiction. That's a notice pleading jurisdiction, the federal courts. And so even under notice pleading, some of these cases are being dismissed because companies and counsel at the beginning didn't lay out the measures that they take to protect their trade secrets. And then on the counter end of that, now most of these cases, as is the case with most litigation, result in some sort of settlement, usually some sort of agreed injunction order or consent decree or confidential settlement agreement or something like that. But in the cases that actually went to verdict, and when we say verdict, we mean summary judgment or trial, the defendants actually won more than the plaintiffs did. And when you peel that onion back a little bit more, in most of those 54% success rates for the defendants, the reason why the person lost or why the company lost was because they didn't show and the jury wasn't convinced that they took reasonable steps to protect their trade secrets. So then the next question that Marcus and I always get is, well, what do we need to do? And the short answer is, it depends. The courts are clear that you don't have to be Superman, that you do not have to take every step humanly possible to get there and say, you know, hey, we basically have the Fort Knox of protection here at our company. That's not necessary or required under the law. But what is required, and this is what makes it, you know, interesting and somewhat difficult to always define it because it is a gray area, it has to be reasonable under the circumstances. And there is a couple high-level things that we can always say are covered by that. One, you have to have some sort of prevention protocol in place. And we'll talk about this a little while from now. Agreements, policies, manuals, protections on your computer systems, things like that. Another thing that has always been shown, again, talking at a 3,000-foot view here, is that if your trade secret gets out, you need to go out there and get it back and try to fix the leak and minimize the damage. And so for those of you, for example, that you know have perhaps multiple lawsuits and trade secret non-compete lawsuits filed, you know, over the 3 or 4 or 5 years, you have to be also concerned not only about those, but also about the ones that you don't file on. You need to always show the court that whenever something gets out there, whether you filed a lawsuit or not, you took efforts to get that back. Because if during discovery, a defendant finds out that the customer list that you're saying is a trade secret, you let someone 18 months ago walk out the door with and didn't get it back or didn't try to get back, that's going to blow your trade secret protection. And that goes then to the last bullet point here that talks about take appropriate steps to safeguard security and the confidential information secrecy. And so a lot of those best practices really form into this, you know, ACE audit, which another name for it could be stress test, creating a culture of enforceability, and then enforcing, like I just mentioned before, that, you know, you take steps to enforce and protect that agreement or those confidential information, when it gets out in the open. And again, and as I mentioned just a moment ago, consistency is key. You can't let the trade secret A go out the door and then 6 months later file a lawsuit claim that trade secret A is still a trade secret because the court's going to say, nope, sorry. Once that protection is gone, it's gone forever and you're not going to be able to get it back. So creating a culture of confidentiality, you know, it really starts with making sure that your employees, your brokers, your dealers, your agents, your reps, you know, everybody understands that this is confidential information that the company needs to keep confidential because it gets a competitive advantage, i.e. makes money off of this information not being known by its competitors. You know, the one of the cardinal rules that we all get brought up by our moms and dads are, you know, treat others how you would like to be treated. That applies here too. You know, you want to take steps that protect your confidential information. And conversely, if somebody brings something to you that they shouldn't have, you want to make sure that you're giving that back and it's not getting put on your systems. It's not creating an argument where somebody could say that you're a bad actor, you act with bad hands, so therefore, you know, you don't protect things, so you shouldn't get the treatment of protection by the courts or FINRA. Manuals, modules, a lot of those things are very important, talking about what the do's and don'ts are. You must keep this information confidential. You must keep this information in a secured place. You don't give this information out to a third party. You don't take this information, download it on a flash drive, or you don't take this information and send it to your Gmail account. Those are the things that you want to see in training modules and policies and manuals and things like that. And the, one of the things that we always talk about is we say here, make security protocols easy to understand. Really, KISS comes in to play here, and that's, you know, keep it simple, stupid. The easier it is to read, the easier it is for people to understand. And if you ever get to that point where you have to go into court or a FINRA arbitration panel, the easier it is for you to understand, it's the easier it is to you convey it to the panel, to the judge, the easier it is for the judge and the panel to understand and to grant you the relief that you're seeking. And we'll talk a couple in a moment about what that relief can consist of. Now, you know, some specifics: agreements, employment agreements, shareholders agreements, partnership agreements, stock agreements, bonus agreements, all any type of agreement that you have with your employees can and a lot oftentimes should include some statements or paragraphs about what the employee can and cannot do with respect to your confidential information. For example, they can only use it to benefit the company. They agree to not take any information with them when they leave. They agree to honor any restrictive covenants that would be in your agreements, you know, when they leave, things like that. I already mentioned policies and handbooks. Same thing applies with confidentiality agreements with third parties. And then the last one, and probably in today's digital age and how everybody is becoming more and more tech savvy, it's the network and the facility that you always have to make sure is secure. Now, most of the people on this call, I'm sure, you know, you have password protections, you have all sorts of security measures that right now are pretty common. I'm just an outside Joe. I don't belong or work for ABC Finance Company. Therefore, I can't get into ABC's internal network, you know, that would have customer information, stock preferences, options, puts, things like that in it. You know, that's good. Taking it a step forward, and what Marcus and I have been seeing more and more of, especially in the last year to 18 months, is monitoring tools. And that means that there's software now in place, and some have been internally designed by companies. Others have had third parties come in and do it for them. But it is information that identifies when somebody's doing something that they shouldn't. Like, for example, if a flash drive is being plugged into a computer and a customer list is being downloaded, are a financial preferential sheet or trailing 12s are being sent to a Gmail account or a Hotmail account or something like that, the software gives the HR department or legal department, or in some cases both, a heads up that, hey, something's going on here that's out of the norm, shouldn't be going on, this needs to be investigated. It also computer programs and software also allows us to retrace electronic footprints. So somebody walks out the door unexpectedly, you go in and you find out that they came into the office at 6 p.m. on a Sunday and left at 1 in the morning, and they had never done that in the 15 years that they had worked for you. Or you could see that they were accessing files and things that they weren't supposed to be accessing. Those are things that, you know, these new monitoring tools are very good to have. And the last thing I would also add here is you want to make sure that your data security, your data privacy, those types of policies and manuals that all of you have nowadays are consistent with the confidentiality language and the confidentiality restrictions, obligations, duties that you find and employment agreements, restrictive covenant agreements, NDAs, things like that. And the other thing I would add is it makes a lot of sense, especially in today's day and age with how fast everything is evolving on a technological basis, to run stress tests. And what I mean by that is you can do these audits or these stress tests where you actually see how susceptible your company is from an internal threat as well as an external threat. And you can see, are you truly taking the steps that you need to protect confidential information? One of these that I did recently, for example, we did a stress test for a rather large financial institution, and it turned out that basically everybody within one unit could see everybody's customer information, their names, their addresses, their telephone numbers, their date of birth, their social security number. What we did was we changed that and we modified that so that only the individual brokers could see their individual client bases. So that, in other words, Broker Joe could see all of his client information for his clients that he services, but he can't see Sally's broker client information. Those are the types of things that stress tests can help to reveal. And so those are one of the things I would encourage people to think about when you're talking about, okay, what do I need to do to protect our confidential information from getting out the door? And then, you know, another protection is, you know, this is where Marcus and I probably spend the lion's share of our time when it comes to litigation, is the rogue employee or the sloppy employee. And sloppy employees aren't always guilty employees. You know, we've had cases where the sloppy employee left the preferential and the trailing 12 history of clients on their desk, and somebody walked over and just walked out with it. So whether they're rogue or sloppy, you need to take steps to make sure that only the people who need the confidential information to do their job are actually getting it. You also want to make sure with respect to your networks and your systems that they only are accessing those parts of the systems that they need to access in order to do their jobs. When it comes to termination, whether it's a voluntary termination or an involuntary termination, you should always have a checklist. And part of that checklist should include making sure that they understand their agreements, that they're going to follow them, that they have returned all their confidential information, that they don't have any confidential information on a flash drive, that they don't have any confidential information at home. They don't have anything, say, for example, on their home iPad. And if they do, you want to make sure that you are the person handling that exit interview goes and gets that information right away. Because again, it goes back to that slide a few slides before where we talk about if you don't take the steps to get it back, the courts aren't going to say that you're exercising reasonable measures to protect it. And again, not to sound like a broken record, but these types of things, these are what the stress tests and the audits are designed to capture. And again, this doesn't mean that you need to perp walk somebody out the door. That's not what Marcus and I are saying. But what you can do, and all of you I'm sure can do it in a professional manner, is you need to make sure that the individual who's leaving your company is not taking any information that you consider confidential, that the company considers integral to its business, out the door, and especially then going to a competitor and using it against you. So what do you do when the information gets out the door? Well, the first thing you need to do is secure the information and assess the damage. And a lot of this means forensic imaging. And one of the questions that Marcus and I get from time to time is it okay to do that internally? And the answer is yes, as long as you have individuals and, you know, I would assume is your IT group who knows how to image and preserve information. What you do not want to do is if you think that that individual sent information to their Gmail account on their company laptop, is to get that company laptop and then open it up and search it yourself. You first want to take an image of that laptop, and ideally, the third-party forensic individual is doing that. But we understand, you know, costs involved, time involved, things like that. So if you have a sophisticated IT department, they can secure that, make sure that the computer doesn't get recycled, and they can take images of that, assuming that they have the capacity to do so, and then they set that off. But the big thing here is always preserving. The second thing is send out those cease and desist letters. Hey, give us that information back. And if they don't respond to it right away, pursue legal action, and we'll talk about your different steps in a second. In some states, under the federal laws, there might be situations where, you know, privacy laws have been breached, and you need to take steps to notify the individuals affected. Rarely is this the case, but in some situations, you have insurance that you need to notify. And then once all of this is done, the question that I always like to ask people is, how did we get here? You know, how did that information get taken out? How did, this get to the step where we had to file this lawsuit? Because those are really good learning lessons and learning experiences that you can then learn from and take those steps to prevent it from happening again. So then legal options. Well, and we'll talk about FINRA in a second, but typically, for confidential information, you have, as Marcus talked about, the Defend Trade Secrets Act and the Uniform Trade Secret Act, except for New York, which own case law is basically Uniform Trade Secret Act. But there also are a couple other claims, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. There's also fiduciary duty and duty of loyalty claims. There may also be, depending what jurisdiction you're in, state law claims. The one thing that I think a lot of people forget about is a lot of times they run into court and they run in right on a TRO saying, we got to stop this. And they forget the second part of that, which I think is almost more important. And that is the motion for expedited discovery. And what that means is it puts everything on a fast track, and you should always be filing that motion for expedited discovery along with your request for a TRO or a preliminary injunction. And what that expedited discovery request means is that you're asking, you know, to immediately go in and image any computers or cell phones or iPads that aren't in your custody, care, or control. You know, a lot of companies, you know, they're BYOB, right? You bring your own, or BYOD, excuse me, bring your own device to work. And with respect to those, the company doesn't own that phone, doesn't own that iPad. So you need that court order to go in and get that forensics and get that stuff done. And you want to do that right away. And by filing that motion for expedited discovery, it tells the court this is serious. You're not messing around. You know, it's another good thing to have and to show the court when you're asking for that preliminary injunction. It also can lead to, you know, them answering discovery in a short amount of time, 7 days, appearing for a deposition, 7-14 days, things like that. And then, you know, the injunctive relief, temporary restraining orders, which are typically only good for 10 days, preliminary injunctions, and permanent injunctions. On the damages side, it's what you would expect: lost profits, harm to your goodwill, diminished value of the trade secret, reasonable royalties. Both the Uniform Trade Secret Act and the Defense Trade Secret Act also allows you to recover unjust enrichment. So, you know, in this situation where maybe, you know, your best damage here is not so much the cost that came to you, but the unjust enrichment that they got from using your trade secret. Though all of those are the types of damages that we typically see with respect to trade secret as well as non-compete cases. Also, attorney's fees are recoverable under both the Defend Trade Secret and Uniform Trade Secret Act if you can show malicious, willful, and wanton misappropriation. They are, if it's in your contract. A lot of these contracts have attorney's fees provisions. One of the things that you should be aware of is that there are certain states, Florida is one that comes to mind, where if you have a one-sided attorney's fees provision, Florida statute makes that a mutual attorney's fees provision. So the other side can get attorney's fees against you even in Florida, even though your agreement may say, hey, only my company can recover attorney's fees if it's successful on proving a breach, obtaining an injunction, things like that. There's also criminal referrals. If you've been reading some of the blogs, like our blog, for example, TradingSecrets.com, as well as some of the other, you know, Law 360s and the like publications, you'll see that the Department of Justice has taken a somewhat of a vested interest, and definitely more of an interest than they ever have been before, about trade secret theft. Now, for the most part, that trade secret excitement govern, you know, that's being generated by the Department of Justice tends to be involving a foreign governmental entity or somebody who's going to work in a foreign company. For example, I mentioned earlier that Marcus and I are located in Chicago. Here in the Northern District, just last week, an individual who was working for an iron manufacturer got convicted of 6 counts of trade secret theft under the criminal portions of the Trade Secret Act and the Economic Espionage Act because he downloaded 1,900 files of confidential product mix within a span of 20 minutes and then tried to board a plane to China where he was going to go and work for a Chinese competitor. So those are the type of cases that the FBI, the Department of Justice, seem to be really focused in on. So it's not every run-of-the-mill trade secret case, but if it's something that's high net worth, high value, again, to the FBI, to the Department of Justice, they are willing to work. And Marcus and I have both worked with the FBI as well as the Secret Service, and because the Secret Service falls under the Treasury Department, the Treasury Department has jurisdiction in some of the types of these cases. We work with them in order to package the materials necessary for the FBI, for the Secret Service to execute the necessary warrants. So now the question is FINRA, and I suspect most of you on this webinar today or attending this webinar today are FINRA members. And FINRA does a couple things that are unique. You know, and it really falls into what I would call the three rules, 13804, 13209, and 11870, which is former rule 2140. With respect to that, there are rule 1308 and 13209, where we are allowed to file injunctions in state or federal court, but then we also must simultaneously file that action with respect to FINRA. And what those rules then allow us to do is they allow us to file and seek a temporary restraining order, obtain an order from the court, but then after the judge issues that ruling, we then have to go through FINRA for the rest of the proceedings. And within 15 days, FINRA panel convenes and decides whether or not to grant us temporary relief, preliminary relief, permanent relief. Or put it another way, it decides whether to continue the judge's order, modify the judge's order, or rescind the judge's order. Now, one of the things that's interesting with respect to 13804 is it talks about a temporary injunction. It doesn't say temporary restraining order or preliminary injunction. So one of the things that you'll see done from time to time, and it's up to the judge as to whether or not they'll allow it, is whether they'll allow expedited discovery. In other words, you move for expedited discovery and a preliminary injunction, say 30 days down the line, as opposed to moving for a temporary restraining order. And in that situation, you know, one of the things that you don't get in FINRA that you do get in a court of law is depositions. And so sometimes what you'll see and what savvy lawyers will do is that they'll file a motion for expedited discovery, ask for a preliminary injunction 14, 21 days from then, and then try to depose the individuals that have left the company. Again, it's judicial discretion. Some judges do it, some judges don't. Conversely, one of the defense tactics, if you don't want your individual sitting for a deposition, if you want it strictly just fight it out in FINRA, is you can agree to a temporary injunction and just say to the judge, we don't need any discovery here. We're going to do it all in FINRA. We'll agree to a temporary injunction and let FINRA figure it out in 15 days. So those are some of the things that you just want to be thinking about from a tactical, strategic standpoint when you have decided to move into court. The other thing that comes up a lot is what I mentioned, Rule 11870, which was formerly 2140. And what you'll see from time to time is somebody will say in response to a cease and desist letter or in response to a TRO hearing or even in a FINRA arbitration hearing is that they'll say, hey, listen, you can't enforce that non-compete. You can't get mad at me for taking your confidential information because Rule 11870 says you cannot prevent account transfers. And the response back to that is they're absolutely right. You cannot prevent account from transferring. But if you read the notes, the FINRA notes on Rule 11870, it specifically states that this rule does not affect non-competes, and it doesn't perfect confidentiality agreements. So the response back when you get that is, no, we're not blocking any accounts from being transferred. The accounts that are out the door are out the door, and we will honor those ACATs. What we are seeking, Judge, is an order preventing them from soliciting these clients, from contacting these clients, from using our confidential information to contact these clients. And then the last one is Rule 2273, which got put in place about 27 months or so ago. And with respect to that rule, that requires certain disclosures of information when a client is thinking about switching brokers. And what we've seen in some situations is companies and firms taking the position, hey, this allows me to send a solicitation piece, a marketing piece to the company. That can't be considered a solicitation. But that's not what Rule 2273 says. What Rule 2273 says is after you have taken a position and reached out to that client about them coming over and they've decided that they are thinking about or want to come over to you, you have to give them this information. So Rule 2273 cannot be used as a bar to enforcing a solicitation agreement or a restrictive covenant that says you agree not to solicit customers for a certain period of time, nor does Rule 2273 allow them to take confidential information when they leave. So those are some of the things that you should be thinking about when that day comes where you're deciding from a strategic standpoint, how are you going to enforce your agreements? How are you going to recover your confidential information through a court of law and through FINRA? And as I mentioned a little bit, and we covered some of these just now, there's key differences between court and FINRA. Obviously, the most important one or the biggest one is no depositions. Also, court litigation, you get full discovery. You have the weight of the court behind you. FINRA, it's less formal. It's limited. They don't follow the rules of evidence. A lot of times it's, you know, the wild, wild west or whatever the chair decides discovery is. You also don't have experts typically like you do in court. You pretty much just go off trailing 12s with respect to damages and revenue. There is no court choice of law your requirements with respect to FINRA litigation with one exception. I'll mention that in a second. It's really just arbitrator justice. And they can decide based not upon a law, but upon what they feel is right, with one exception. And that goes back to FENRA Rule 13804, with respect to that injunction hearing, they do specifically say in Rule 13804 that the arbitration panel, which is convened on an expedited basis, pretty much within 7 days, and you have 3 days to strike from the list, and then the panel is selected. But it does say that that panel is supposed to follow, with respect to restrictive covenants, the law of the state where the broker-dealer resides, or the law of the state that's stated in the agreement. Now, from a practical purpose, is that always followed? No. And as we all know, sometimes they're supposed to give reasoned opinions, but they don't always do that. The same can be said here. So it's good to know, and in your briefs before FENRA, your position papers, you should mention that this is the law and this agreement is enforceable under the law, and that's what the rule says, but in practice, it's not always followed. So then the last thing is the protocol for broker recruiting. And for those of you that aren't familiar about it, it was an agreement that was started about 15 years ago by four banks, Citigroup, Smith Barney, Merrill Lynch, and UBS. It gained momentum during the financial crisis, really exploded in the 2008, 2009, 2010 time frame, where now it's over 1,200 signatories. And what it basically does is it says you cannot enforce a restrictive covenant agreement with respect to customer non-solicits if you do certain things. Now, one of the things that we should mention here, in addition to the fact that an outside law firm now handles the membership and who is not a signatory, but there has been a shifting away from it. Most notably last year, Morgan Stanley and UBS rescinded their membership in the protocol. And that was a very big deal because they were part of the founders. And they have since, in the last year or so, last 18 months, have been enforcing their agreements. We have seen actual cases involving them. And so to dial it in a little deeper, what it allows you to take is client name, address, telephone number, email address, title. It also allows the broker to solicit clients that they service at their former firm as long as they resign in the way stated by the protocol, which says that basically you are giving your boss a list of the client information that you're taking. If they follow the protocol's requirements, then the firm that they're leaving can't go after them with respect to damages or injunctive relief for soliciting those customers. And what was interesting is, especially when this started, is I think a lot of firms didn't realize that they now had an internal conflict because they had these confidentiality and restrictive covenants that said, hey, you're not going to take this information. This is our confidential information. And the protocol that they just signed on to said, oh, yes, I can, which also then hurt them when they tried to recover that information in a court or FINRA proceeding because they were no longer seen taking reasonable measures to protect it. Similarly, a lot of firms had restrictive customer solicitation provisions saying, for 1 year, you agree not to solicit the customers that you worked with. And all of a sudden, the protocol, by signing it, tossed those out. And so people and firms then had to come up with ways to say, okay, I need to now get consistent in my internal processes. So for those of you that are maybe considering joining the protocol, as well as those of you that are thinking about leaving the protocol, you need to look through your agreements as well as your manuals and see if you're consistent and are you consistent throughout, because that's going to make a big deal when it then comes into litigation. And there's really four types, right? There's the signatory, plaintiff, and defendant. In other words, both people are part of the protocol. Then what happens when the plaintiff's part of the protocol and the defendant is not, or when the plaintiff is not part of the protocol and the defendant is? And the easiest one, obviously, is both plaintiff and defendant are part of the protocol. If they are, you follow the protocol. It's a simple decision by FINRA or the court. Did the defendants follow what they're required to in the protocol? If they did, fine. If they didn't, then they can still be held liable. So in other words, if they didn't leave that list with their manager of who's information they were taking, courts can enforce restrictive covenant agreements. Similarly, if they took more information that's allowed under the protocol, courts and FINRA can enforce those agreements. What gets interesting, though, is when both sides aren't part of the protocol. I'm sorry, where one side isn't part of the protocol. And with respect to when the plaintiff is a protocol member and the defendant is not a protocol member, the courts basically say, tough, we don't care about the protocol, protocol plaintiff, if you're going to enforce it, you're going to have to follow the rules. What's also interesting is the protocol can't be used as a short or as an industry standard, and this is sort of the fourth line here, and that is two members not part of the protocol. Every once in a while, you'll see somebody trying to make an argument, well, the protocol is industry standard or something like that, and courts have said, no, it's not industry standard. Some people signed off on it, others haven't. We're going to look at strictly the case law, and we're going to look strictly at whether or not you took reasonable steps to protect your confidential information. And if you did, we're going to uphold your agreements. We're going to enforce those restrictive covenants. We're going to order that information be returned, and we're going to award damages. And the same thing is followed with the FINRA arbitration panels. Now, again, this, as I mentioned earlier, impacts your confidentiality obligations, restrictive covenants, your team agreements. And one of the things that we always talk about people when there's a merger or an acquisition is, are you joining somebody that's a protocol firm, or are you acquiring somebody that's a protocol firm? A rather large brokerage house had a big issue with this about 6 or 7 years ago because the acquiring firm was part of the protocol. The acquiree was not. And basically what happened was the protocol voices carried the day, and that firm then agreed to allow the protocol to cover all of the new company, which was not very well received by those individuals who had been enforcing the restrictive covenants for years upon years. This is where we take a break for a minute, and we'll go and answer your questions. But one thing that we always mention in the words of one of our founders, Ben Franklin, is an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And with respect to that phrase, it really holds true with respect to trade secrets, not only in the financial industry, but in an industry. If you can take steps to prevent your trade secrets going out the door, that's always better. It's always a lot less expensive than having to force to get those trade secrets back when you're doing it either through a FINRA proceeding, through a court proceeding, or through both. And so with that, we'll take one quick second. We'll read through your questions, and Marcus will be back in about 30 seconds or so, maybe less, to answer the first question. But again, thank you for your time. And the CLE code is, once again, SS, so Seyfarth Shaw, so S as in Seyfarth, S as in Shaw, 4672.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will conduct the question and answer session. And to ask a question via the web presentation, select the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen and type in your question that way. And we will begin as soon as we have the questions. Thank you so much. I do see a question that has arisen. I'll turn it over to you.
All right, so we have a question, and I'll read out loud here. Are most clients coming to you with existing breach issues, or are they proactively seeking to implement best practices for trade secret protection? The answer is both. We often have clients come to us, and they're looking for, I think Scott called it, stress testing their existing methods and processes to keep information confidential, as well as we often update confidentiality agreements and employment agreements that contain protections to keep trade secret information confidential. And then certainly it's, I think Scott mentioned, part of keeping trade secret status for information is meaning when someone does something wrong and misappropriates that information, is taking aggressive action to protect it and minimizing the damage by that misappropriation. And so we're often tasked with getting involved in both pre-litigation as well as litigation matters to protect information. All right, Scott, you have anything to add on that?
No, I think that's absolutely right. And I think that we have seen an uptick in the trade secret audits and the stress tests a lot because of what's been, you know, talked about in the media the last couple of years about the hacking, about, you know, threats coming from both internal as externals. I think the need as well as the desire to take proactive steps is greater now than it ever has been in the past. But, you know, just with anything, you have both sides, as Marcus pointed out. You know, some people coming after, you know, the horse has left the barn and we need to take, you know, steps right away, and others saying, hey, you know what, Ben Franklin's right. Let's take the steps now to limit our exposure, our potential exposure down the line. And then I see we're at 1 o'clock. We do have one additional question, and that is additional consideration needed to add the defend trade secrets language? I assume that that's referring to the whistleblower language that Marcus referred to earlier. And the answer to that is no. You know, a lot of you are familiar with when you enter into trade secret, restrictive covenant agreements. For existing employees, a lot of states require additional consideration in order for that to be effective. With respect to this confidential information, with respect to trade secrets, the answer is no, because you're not asking them to assume an additional restriction or anything like that. In fact, the whistleblower language that allows you to give attorney's fees actually gives the individual, the employee, an additional line of protection. So with that, again, Marcus and I thank you for your time. We appreciate you taking, you know, this past hour or so spending with us. I have one last slide. One, please feel free to check our trade secrets blog, www.tradesecretslaw.com. We keep it up to date on the most recent trends, cases with respect to trade secrets, not only in the financial industry, but across all industries. And also, here is our contact information. Please feel free to reach out to us via email if you have any additional questions or if anything comes to you, you know, down the line about this presentation. Marcus and I would be happy to answer those questions. And so with that, Marcus and I will sign off. And again, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Good. Oh, real quick. Did anybody hear my dog? Damn.
Yes.
I apologize.
Got me look at a scance, and I was like, "That's Scott's dog."
At first, yeah. I couldn't tell if you like cleared your throat or like laughed or something. I was like, "That definitely sounded like a bark."
Yeah, it was. I mean, God damn it.
It was so quick. I wouldn't give it a second thought.
A one little bark, so I think it was fine.
Yeah, no. So you guys know, so I can feel a little bit better about myself, is So the reason why I'm home is my son's in the hospital, and my youngest has a half day. So I'm with her, and Meg is down with Mitch. And I told her, don't come in here because she didn't want to watch the dog. I'm like, I'll watch the dog, but don't come in here because you come in here, the dog's going to bark. So what does she do? She bangs on the door. She's like, I didn't come in. I'm like, are you freaking kidding me?
is Mitch doing okay?
He's been in for over a week. So it's been a long week. Let's put it that way. But hopefully the doctor's figuring it out. I can't remember how much I've told you, but it basically has what's called this Chiari malformation, which means that his brain's too big for his skull right now, and the brain presses on the spinal cord and the spinal fluid, which causes these severe migraines. And he had been taking medicine for it for the last 5 years, and they warned us that when puberty would start, that the medicine could stop working, and that's what happened. And so he's been out of school for the last 5 weeks, and they've been trying to get his meds corrected, to treat it, and it just hasn't worked. So they said, listen, we got to put him in the hospital for at least a week to 10 days to observe him and just basically run a whole bunch of different medical cocktails to see what'll work. So he went in last Thursday. They've gotten the days taken care of so that the migraines are gone during the days, and he's back to being his normal self, which is great. But at night, it's literally between 2 and 4 a.m., they just hit, and that's what they've been struggling with, to try to break that migraine cycle. So the migraines have gotten less severe the last couple of days at night, which is a good sign, so he's trending in the right direction. But if they can't get it figured out, then they might have to do surgery, and that's a long haul. So,
well, I really hope that's not the case. That
you and me both.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah.
That's terrible. So I'm sure it's hard on Mitch and hard on you and Meg and the whole family.
Yeah. But thanks. So that's why I'm home and wasn't downtown. And and now you see how many people don't listen to me in my house. My daughter, my dog, nobody.
Well, we kind of assume that.
True. True.
All right. Well, I guess hopefully you're able to take care of all the work stuff easily and spend time with Mitch and doing what you need to do.
Okay. Yep. So. All right.
All right.
I will talk to you guys later.
All right. Sounds good, Scott. Bye.
Thanks.